Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. A former University of Iowa hospital employee pleaded guilty Monday to federal charges that he had been living under another man's identity since 1988, causing the other man to be falsely imprisoned for identity theft and sent to a mental hospital. Matthew David Kearns, 58, was convicted of one count of false statement to a National Credit Union Administration insured institution, punishable by up to 30 years in federal prison, and one count of aggravated identity theft, punishable by up to 2 years in federal prison. Kearns worked as a systems architect in the hospital's IT department from June 28, 2013 to July 20, 2023, when he was terminated for misconduct related to the identity theft investigation. A news release from the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Northern District of Iowa said Kearns was an administrator at the hospital, but a hospital representative said he was not a senior leader in the organization. Kearns worked at the hospital under the name William Donald Woods, an alias he had been using since about 1988 when he worked with the real William Woods at a hot dog cart in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Kearns used Woods' identity in every aspect of his life, including obtaining employment, insurance, and official documents, and even paying taxes under the name, according to a plea agreement signed by Kearns. In 1990, Kearns obtained a fraudulent Colorado identification card with Woods' name and birthday. He used the ID to get a job at a fast food restaurant and to get a Colorado bank account. He bought a car for $600 in 1991 using Wood's name with two $300 checks that bounced. In 1994, Kearns got married. He had a child whose last name is Woods. In 2012, 24 years after he started using Woods' name, Kearns fraudulently acquired a copy of Woods' birth certificate from the state of Kentucky using information he found about Woods' family on Ancestry.com. By 2013, Kearns had moved to eastern Wisconsin. He started his IT job with UI Hospitals and worked remotely. He earned more than $700,000 in his 10 years working for the hospital. In 2023, his salary was $140,501, according to the hospital. Kearns obtained multiple vehicle and personal loans from Iowa Credit Union under Woods' name between 2016 and 2022, totaling more than $200,000. He also had money stored in a national bank under Woods' name, court documents state. In 2019, the real William Woods was homeless in Los Angeles. He went to a branch of the National Bank and explained that he recently discovered someone was using his credit and had accumulated a lot of debt. Woods gave the bank employee his real Social Security card and an authentic California identification card, which matched the information the bank had on file. Because there was a large amount of money in the accounts, the bank employee asked Woods a series of security questions that he was unable to answer. The bank employee called Kearns, whose phone number was connected to the accounts. He answered the security questions correctly and said no one in California should have access to his accounts. The employee called the Los Angeles Police Department. After an investigation, the real Woods was arrested and charged with identity theft and false impersonation. Because Woods continued to insist throughout the judicial process that he was William Woods and not Matthew Kearns, a judge ruled in February 2020 that he was not mentally competent to stand trial, and he was sent to a mental hospital in California, where he received psychotropic psychotropic medication and other mental health treatment. In March 2021, Woods pleaded no contest to the identity theft charges, meaning he accepted the conviction but did not admit guilt. He was sentenced to 2 years in prison, with credit for the 2 years he already served in the county jail and the hospital, and was released. Woods continued to attempt to regain his identity by filing customer disputes with financial organizations in an attempt to clear his credit report. He also reached out to multiple law enforcement agencies, including the Heartland Police Department in Wisconsin, where Kearns lived. Woods eventually discovered where Kearns was working, and in January 2023, he reached out to the University of Iowa Hospital's Security Department, who referred his complaint to the University of Iowa Police Department. University of Iowa Police Detective Ian Mallory opened an investigation into the case. Mallory found the biological father listed on Woods' birth certificate, which both Woods and Kearns had sent him an official copy of, and tested the father's DNA against Woods' DNA. The test proved Woods was the man's son. On July 17, 2023, Mallory interviewed Kearns. He asked Kearns what his father's name was, and Kearns accidentally gave the name of his own adoptive father. Mallory then confronted Kearns with the DNA evidence, and Kearns responded by saying, "My life is over and everything is gone." He then confessed to the prolonged identity theft, according to court documents. Kearns was taken into custody July 18, 2023, and charged in Johnson County with false use of birth certificate and providing false identification information. He pleaded guilty August 14th to false use of birth certificate, and the other charge was dropped. He was sentenced to 20 days in Johnson County Jail. He was indicted December 12th in federal court on 5 counts of false statement to a National Credit Union Administration insured institution and 2 counts of aggravated identity theft. He pleaded guilty Monday to 1 count of each charge, and the other counts were dropped. A sentencing has not yet been scheduled. Kearns is in custody of the U.S. Marshals Service, according to a news release. In the days preceding Paula Scanlon's visit to the University of Iowa, police arrested 2 people on suspicion of stealing and trashing a sign promoting the March 25th lecture by Scanlon, a former teammate of transgender NCAA national champion swimmer Leah Thomas. Scanlon, who was on the University of Pennsylvania swim team with Thomas, is speaking around the country about the difficulty of having a transgender woman in the team's locker room. Between March 18th and 22nd, UI police investigated 6 incidents of vandalism, theft, or property damage involving banners and other Scanlon promotions. They identified several suspects, including a UI academic services coordinator who investigators believe took a large banner off a fence by Hubbard Park at 2:22 p.m. March 20th and threw it in the trash. Although officers haven't arrested that individual, they did charge Wyeth Alexander Platt and Haixiang Wang, both 20 and of Iowa City, with fifth-degree theft just after midnight March 22nd. Both Platt and Wang, according to criminal complaints, were seen on camera stealing a sign from Hubbard Park. They walked to a dumpster to dispose of the sign, which belonged to a student organization. The signs were valued at about $200, according to the complaints. Platt is listed in the UI student directory, Wang is not. Both cases are set for an initial appearance in Johnson County Court on May 1st. Neither returned phone calls from the Gazette seeking comment Thursday. A criminal charge is merely an accusation, and the defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty, UI Campus Safety Chief of Staff and Public Information Officer Haley Bruce said. Reporting officers are investigating each incident separately to determine whether the specific actions taken by each suspect are against the law. Two other UI students who've not been charged are suspected of cutting a sign promoting Scanlon from a fence just before 8 p.m. March 21st, and several other suspects who also haven't been arrested or charged reportedly tore down banners or cut signs from fences in the days preceding. With our Paula Scanlon event, one of the new ways we decided to promote it was having a promotional banner, says Jasmine Jordan, chairwoman of the UI chapter of Young Americans for Freedom, which invited Scanlon to campus. So we had it on the fence of Hubbard Park. They attached the banner using zip ties. And so several times throughout the week, people cut those zip ties, she said, because we previously had one of our promotional things attacked. I decided to get two banners, and that cost $400, which is pretty crazy. Within a couple of days, Jordan said, the first Scanlon banner was completely sliced, so it could not be reattached. Although police followed up with at least two arrests, Jordan said she thinks the vandalism is ironic. Because our banner said, "How the Left Silences Women," she said, and by attacking our poster, you're kind of just silencing the message that's being promoted. She said Young Americans for Freedom posters and promotions seem to be treated differently from others. A proposal to designate the Paglia's Pizza building as a historic landmark is being deferred by the Iowa City Council until it obtains more information. Mayor Bruce Teague requested the deferment during a Tuesday council meeting, saying he was having issues with this one. Council member Mazahir Salah said one issue for her was whether the historic landmark designation would make it more difficult to sell the property, an issue raised by the owner, Gary Scarta. She also noted that historic preservation is focused on the exterior of buildings, asking if it would be possible to include a building's interior in the designation. Ultimately, however, she said she supported rezoning the building to make it a historic landmark. In a 6-0 vote, the council deferred its vote on the matter to its April 16th meeting to consult with the city's Planning and Zoning Commission. The Paglia building at 302 East Bloomington Street was built in 1877. The city's Historic Preservation and the Planning and Zoning Commissions have both recommended approval of the historic landmark designation. Despite the endorsement by city commissions, building owner Scarta is opposed to the historic landmark designation and the rezoning that goes with it. He told the city council he has a lot of memories of the building, but he still wants to be able to sell it. If it is rezoned as a historic landmark, he said developers wouldn't be interested in buying it because they wouldn't be able to develop the site. It would be better for the city, he said, to not designate the building as a landmark so a developer could turn the property into condos or something else that would benefit the city. The building was built by Scarta's great-great-grandfather, Joseph Slezak, in 1877 and has been in Scarta's family since 1878. Paglia's Pizza opened in 1957. Besides Paglia's Pizza, the building houses Laundromania and 16 apartments. In the past, the building has housed a dance hall, a saloon, a hotel, and a grocery store. Scarta listed the building for sale in September 2023. 11 people at Tuesday's meeting spoke in favor of the landmark designation, with some wearing stickers advocating for the building's preservation. Ginalee Swaim, treasurer of Friends of Historic Preservation in Iowa City, said the building was historically important as it was a gathering place for Bohemian immigrants in the area. Willie Oxley, who said he repairs and restores homes, said both his father and grandfather would frequent Paglia's. The nature of these buildings is incredibly intricate and beautiful, he said. These buildings were designed to be repaired, something that we don't think about anymore. Ahead of the meeting, more than 30 local business owners co-signed a letter supporting the landmark designation, saying buildings and businesses like Paglia's make the area a commercial success and are unique to the area. Some speakers, however, said they were bothered by how they perceived SCARTA had been treated and that they believed the landmark designation would limit his right to selling the building. The Iowa City Council has, for the second time, approved rezoning of the former Kirkwood Community College campus at 1816 Lower Muscatine Road, a move that's been met with resistance from some neighbors. The council must approve the rezoning a third time before it goes into effect. The second consideration passed Tuesday in a 5-1 vote, with council member Mazahir Saleh casting the dissenting vote. Council member Laura Burgess was absent. The rezoning would change the former Kirkwood campus from neighborhood public to general industrial at the request of Procter & Gamble, which purchased the 6.8-acre property for $6.4 million. P&G has not said what it will do with the property, which Kirkwood vacated last year. Last month, Joe Townsend, site engineering leader, told the Iowa City Council the company will demolish the Kirkwood buildings and turn the property into a green space until its plan is finalized. Several Iowa City residents spoke Tuesday in opposition to the rezoning. They said they were worried a new P&G plant could adversely affect air quality in the area and subsequently the health of the residents. The Environmental Protection Agency has reported that fine particulate matter in the air, lead paint, traffic, and hazardous materials storage within a 1-mile area around the P&G plant on Lower Muscatine Road is above the 80th percentile. Council member Megan Alter said she thinks the rezoning decision is a difficult one. I do think that we need to look at urban air pollution in the area, Alter said. I'm also a Southeast Side resident, and so it is something that we need to look out for. But, she added, she had toured the existing P&G plants and had confidence the locations are safe to work at, particularly because many employees are union members. Saleh, who also voted against the rezoning at its first consideration, said she was still concerned about air quality in the area and was worried that it could worsen if the council approves the rezoning. Despite pushback from residents, Mackenzie DeRue from Greater Iowa City Incorporated said the organization was in favor of the rezoning. A new P&G plant, she said, would be the first step in further investment in the surrounding area. A Northwest Iowa woman who sought to boost her husband's unsuccessful congressional bid in 2020 through a voter fraud scheme was sentenced this week by a federal judge to 4 months in prison in a rare case of fraudulent voting. Kim Taylor, 50, was convicted by a federal jury in November on 52 counts, including fraudulent voting and providing false information in registering and voting. During the 2020 primary and general elections, prosecutors said, Taylor filled out voter registrations and absentee ballots for members of the Vietnamese community in Sioux City under the guise of offering translation help. Taylor is of Vietnamese descent, and Iowa prohibits election material, including ballots, from being printed in any language but English. prosecutors said Taylor used the ballots to fraudulently generate votes for husband Jeremy Taylor's unsuccessful bid in the Republican primary for a seat in Iowa's 4th Congressional District. The month after his primary loss, he successfully ran for Woodbury County Board of Supervisors and still is in that position. Jeremy Taylor, a former state legislator, was identified in court documents as an unindicted co-conspirator but was not charged with a crime. Kim Taylor, who could have faced a maximum sentence of 5 years in prison per count, must serve 4 months of home confinement following her prison release plus 2 years of probation, as well as $5,200 in court costs. On behalf of Ms. Taylor and her family, we're pleased with the sentencing result, defense attorney F. Montgomery Brown told the Washington Post. Brown had sought a longer home confinement term in lieu of prison and said the court was given extensive mitigated background information on Taylor, including a considerable body of letters of support. Chief U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand acknowledged as part of his sentencing decision that Taylor had no prior criminal record and was the primary caregiver to her and her husband's 6 children and her elderly mother. Eliza Swearenbecker, senior counsel in the Voting Rights and Elections Program at the Brennan Center for Justice, said that in general, instances of fraud related to elections are exceedingly rare, largely because of the strength of the voter integrity rules. The typical prosecutions the Brennan Center has tracked in recent years do not involve people working on behalf of a candidate, but rather ordinary people who made mistakes as they attempted to sincerely assist voters, she said. Those honest mistakes shouldn't be the subject of prosecution, Swearenbecker added. With hundreds of U.S. newspaper closings leaving legions with little access to local news, a college newspaper in Iowa has stepped up to buy 2 struggling weekly publications. The move by the Daily Iowan, a nonprofit student paper based at the University of Iowa, is believed to be a first, though other universities are stepping up to fill America's news void in different ways. Students will work alongside the paper's existing 1 or 2-person reporting staffs and put themselves to work covering the small communities of Mount Vernon, Lisbon, and Solon. The weekly's owner proposed the buyout to save the publications, which have a combined circulation of 1,900. It's really a great way to help the problems of news deserts in rural areas, said Sabini Martin, executive editor of the Daily Iowan, who will edit stories for one of the papers. She already oversees editorial operations for a school paper whose tax filings show had more than $2 million in net assets. Since 2005, the U.S. has lost about 70% of newsroom jobs and 1/3 of all newspapers, said Zach Metzger, director of the State of Local News Project at Northwestern University. He described the industry's downfall as a cliff dive. Traditional media has been in that dive since big tech and social media began siphoning off the monster share of advertising dollars. Richard Watts, director for the Center for Community News at the University of Vermont, said his group has identified 120 university-led student reporting programs that provide local news. A handful of college publications already had been heavily invested in local news, including the University of Missouri, where professional editors supervise journalism students who have produced a community newspaper for decades. It's a microcosm of industry experimentation, said Barbara Allen, director of college programming at the Poynter Institute, a journalism think tank. each college newspaper attack on news deserts, that is, the wide swaths of U.S. communities with no dedicated source of local news, looks different. Some report on state legislatures and distribute the stories statewide. Others produce stories for Spanish language publications or expand their coverage beyond campus events so they can circulate their papers throughout the community, Watts said. The man behind selling the two Iowa papers is Bob Woodward, no relation to the Watergate scandal reporter. His family's business, Woodward Communications, was trying to figure out what to do with two properties that weren't performing very well. Woodward knew that journalism students at the University of Kansas run an online news site for a nearby community that lost its newspaper. He also knew that the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication saved a 148-year-old weekly, the Oglethorpe Echo, in 2021 by taking it over and turning it into a nonprofit that students write stories for. The deal went through virtually for free, distinguishing it from the Iowa Daily Iowan transaction. And then there is the University of Oregon, where students stepped up to help the Eugene Weekly after it fell victim to an embezzlement scheme in late 2023 that forced layoffs. The students even helped break a story that led to the local school superintendent being ousted, said Peter Laufer, chair of the university's journalism school. With these stories in mind, Woodward approached the Daily Iowan's publisher, Jason Brummond, and asked if it would be interested in a deal. "We don't like being in the business of closing newspapers, frankly, or even selling them, but we just felt like they probably deserved a better home," said Woodward, who stepped down as vice president of the news business earlier this year to oversee fundraising to pay reporters. Brummond took the proposals to Student Publications Incorporated, the nonprofit that manages the Daily Iowan, and its board approved it unanimously. The board's chair, Ryan J. Foley, is an AP correspondent in Iowa City who graduated from the university in 2003. The deal was finalized in February, with the nonprofit that runs the Daily Iowan taking over the Mount Vernon, Lisbon Sun, and the Solon Economist. Neither Woodward nor Brummond disclosed the sale price, though Woodward described it as a fairly nominal amount. Brummond said student publications may be required to disclose the amount in a tax filing. "Interviews will start soon for interns for the two Iowa papers," said Brummond, who also is serving as publisher of the two weeklies. "So far, the work has been mainly behind the scenes, absorbing the paper's half-dozen part and full-time reporters and ad employees, and redesigning the publication's print and online editions. By fall, university reporting classes will assign stories on the two communities, and the editors will decide whether to use them. Ultimately, non-journalism majors might be enlisted to help with the business side of operations." Brummond said, "Our hope for this is that these are sustainable models that are producing really good journalism." Nathan Countryman, the editor at the Mount Vernon Lisbon Sun, is eager for the help covering meetings, graduation, and beloved community events like sauerkraut days. More importantly, though, the deal means the paper won't close. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 5th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Shelby Jean Foley, age 81, of Cedar Rapids, passed away after a long illness on Monday, April 1st, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Shelby was born June 5, 1942, in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. She graduated from high school and worked as a nurse and then shifted her career to flowers and gardening, owning her own flower shop and craft store in Pennsylvania. Shelby married Terrence Terry Lee Foley on December 12, 1992, in Virginia, and they eventually moved to Cedar Rapids, where they made their home. She volunteered for the Linn County Master Gardeners and received the Master Gardener of the Year Award and became a lifetime Master Gardener. Per Shelby's wishes, there will be no services. Memorials may be directed to Critter Crusaders of Cedar Rapids or Linn County Master Gardeners in Hiawatha. Marion Lois Duhachik, 99, of Tama, passed away Tuesday, April 2nd, at Unity Point Iowa Methodist Medical Center in Des Moines. A memorial service will be held Monday, April 8th, at 11 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Tama. Interment will follow at National Cemetery in rural Vining. A memorial visitation will be held Monday, April 8th, from 10 to 11 a.m. prior to the service at the church. Marion was born May 30, 1924, in Gunnison, Colorado. After her parents moved back to Tama County, Marion attended Columbia Township No. 2 Country School and later graduated from Tama High School in 1942. She was also employed by the telephone company as a switchboard operator for several years. On April 26, 1943, she was united in marriage to Frank Duhachik in Marshalltown, Iowa. Frank and Marion farmed southwest of Tama all their lives on their century farm. Marion's occupation as a farm wife included keeping the books, feeding hired hands, neighbors, friends, and family with her wonderful cooking, raising their family, and helping Frank with the daily operation of the farm. Marion was active lifetime parishioner and member of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Tama. Memorials may be directed to St. Paul Lutheran Church in Tama. Karen Lucille Rolena, 84, of Fairfax, passed away on April 3rd at the Winslow House Care Center in Marion. Visitation will be from 3 to 6 p.m. on Sunday, April 7th, at Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of Life service will be 10:30 a.m. Monday, April 8th, at Brosh Chapel. Burial will be in Czech National Cemetery. Karen was born on May 17, 1939, in Tiffin. She attended Madison No. 5 Country School and graduated from Oxford High School in 1957. She earned a degree from Iowa City Business College. Karen was united to Neil Rolena on June 12, 1960, in Iowa City. She worked as a secretary at LaRue Plumbing, then Collins Radio, and later dedicated her life to raising a family and helping others through Campfire Girls, Boy Scouts, and the Antique Auto Club. Memorials may be directed to the Cedar Rapids Metro Parkinson's Association to help fund free programs and operations in her name. Edna Marie Turnipseed, age 89, passed away on Monday, April 1st, with her family by her side at the Pigeon Falls Health Care Center in Pigeon Falls, Wisconsin. Edna was born on February 15, 1935, in Cedar Rapids. She met her future husband, Wendell, through a double date with her brother, Elvin. They married July 22, 1954, and settled in Swisher. Wendell worked for the family feed, lumber, and fertilizer business, and Edna was a homemaker. They were married for 68 years and had one daughter, Michelle. Funeral services will be held on Tuesday, April 9th at 1 p.m. in the Jack Funeral Home in Whitehall. Burial will be in the Skellerville Cemetery in rural Hixton. Friends may call 1 hour prior to the service. Memorials may be directed to the Trempealeau County Humane Society or the Pigeon Falls Fire Department. In non-local obituaries, Adrian Schiller, the actor known for Victoria, dies. British actor Adrian Schiller, whose career included roles in the historical dramas The Last Kingdom and Victoria, has died. Scott Marshall Partners, an agency that represented Schiller for more than 30 years, confirmed to The Times that the actor died Wednesday. Additional details, including a cause of death and his survivors, were not revealed. He was 60. Scott Marshall Partners said in a statement shared with The Times, his death was sudden and unexpected, and no further details around its cause are yet available. The agency added that the prodigiously talented actor recently returned from Sydney, where he performed in a production of the Sam Mendes-directed play The Layman Trilogy. Schiller was looking forward to continuing the play's international run, which included shows at San Francisco's Tony Remby Theater from May 25th to June 23rd. Schiller, who was born February 21, 1964, pursued a variety of opportunities throughout his career, ranging from TV and film to theater and video games. In recent years, however, Schiller was best known for his work on historical dramas The Last Kingdom and Victoria. Television made up a majority of Schiller's decades-long career, which began in the early 90s, according to the IMDb. The actor's additional TV credits include minor roles in Raised by Wolves, Senius, and Doctor Who. Chris Cross, Ultravox bassist and Vienna co-writer, dies at 71. Ultravox bassist Chris Cross, who co-wrote the British New Waves group 1981 Smash Vienna, has died. He was 71. The English bassist, born Christopher Allen, was a founding member of Tiger Lily, the group that became Ultravox in the late 70s and took its cues from the electronics curious post-punk and art rock of the area, The group signed to Island Records and recorded its experimental-minded debut with Brian Eno, but found popular success with Vienna, a drum machine and synth-driven ballad that hit number 2 on the UK pop charts. The song's moody music video, inspired by the spy thriller The Third Man, helped make it one of the defining tracks of an emerging synth-driven movement in pop. In 1985, the band performed at Live Aid, the massive multi-venue famine relief event co-organized by Ultravox singer Midge Ure. And in some local sports, the Marion girls tennis team had high hopes entering this season, with seniors Natalie Hartman and Michaela Goad returning off a third-place finish in the Class 1A doubles tournament, along with three other regulars. The Wolves were primed to be among the best 1A teams in the States. Then the numbers kicked in. For girls' tennis, the top 48 schools in terms of enrollment are placed in Class 2A. When the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union released the final enrollment numbers on March 15th, Marion found itself at number 48, with 15 more students than Council Bluffs Lewis Central. It was something Marion coach Andrea Hansen was not expecting. "We were surprised to see that we were bumped up to 2A this year," she said. Marion is in a sharing agreement for tennis with Alburnett High School. That does add numbers to Marion's total. "We have had a co-op shared agreement in tennis with Alburnett in recent years," Hansen said. "We co-op share with Alburnett in other activities, and it has never changed our classification." Despite moving into 2A, Hansen still has high hopes for her team. If you have ever attended a tennis event over the years at Xavier, one factor always is a constant. With the courts being in an open area up on a hill near the back of the school's campus, windy conditions are the norm for players and spectators. Some changes in the layout of the facility could alleviate some of that wind this season. Last month, windscreens were installed around the courts in time for the start of the season. Xavier girls tennis coach Matt Foxhaven said the upgrades will enhance the experience for all involved. Foxhaven said spectators will be inside the windscreens on one side of the courts with an overhead screen to provide shade on warmer days. Iowa hosts Michigan in baseball, with top two in the batting order out with injury. This has not been the smoothest season so far for the Iowa baseball team. Let's just say it, things have been kind of rough. Considering all of the preseason expectations for these Hawkeyes, now even a little bit rougher this weekend. Head coach Rick Hiller said Thursday morning his team will be without outfielder Sam Peterson and first baseman utility player Andy Nelson for this weekend's home series against Michigan. The series is scheduled to begin today at 2 p.m., and then, due to wet weather expected Sunday, a doubleheader Saturday that will begin at 1:05 p.m. Taking these two guys out of the lineup will definitely be a challenge for us, Heller said. Iowa leads the Big Ten Conference in batting average at .320 and runs scored, thanks in part to Nelson and Peterson. Nelson is third in the league in batting average at .408 and has provided the Hawkeyes with an exquisite leadoff hitter. He has had recurring issues with his hamstring. Peterson leads the Big Ten in runs and is second in stolen bases. Heller said he has been dealing with shin splints and was on the verge of a crack in his leg bone, forcing him to wear a boot and sit this weekend. The coach hopes both will be able to turn, even if on a limited basis, for Iowa's series next week against Ohio State. Iowa sits 15-11 overall and 4-2 in the Big Ten. It has won both of its conference series thus far against Purdue and Minnesota. Those series were identical in that the Hawkeyes dropped the first game and rebounded to win the next two. With that in mind, Heller said his club will reconfigure its starting pitching rotation this weekend. Cade Obermuller will pitch today's game, followed by Marcus Morgan and Brody Brecht. Ace Brecht, a possible first-round pick in this summer's Major League Baseball draft, has given up 13 runs, 10 earned, over 8 innings in his last two starts. Heller said Brecht has done extra bullpen work this week with pitching coach Sean McGrath, necessitating his drop to Sunday starter. Resharpening Brecht's slider has been the emphasis. While Iowa has been great offensively this season, as Heller mentioned, pitching has been an issue. The Hawkeyes go into the weekend with a 6.14 team earned run average and have allowed the second most walks in the Big Ten. The bullpen in particular has been inconsistent, failing to hold several leads, with lack of control playing a large role. Heller noted how Jack Young, Aaron Savory, and Ben Tatay have begun to be consistent performers out of the pen. He hopes others will follow. Linn County has been recognized as a dementia-friendly community by Dementia Friendly America, a national network of health organizations that seek to support people living with dementia. Officials with the Chris and Susie DeWolf Family Innovation Center for Aging and Dementia of Mercy submitted an application to receive the Dementia Friendly designation at the beginning of March and were approved just a couple of days later, according to Kathy Good, director of the Innovation Center. The reason that we applied and that we now have joined the Dementia Friendly America Network under the name of Dementia Friendly Linn County is because that whole effort is, on a national level, to help educate people about what living with dementia is like and, obviously, to reduce the stigma, Good said. The Dementia Friendly America Network provides communities with resources for ensuring community members and businesses are educated about what living with dementia looks like. Individual community members can become a designated dementia friend by taking a short course online, and businesses and other organizations can connect with the dementia-friendly Linn County Action Team to schedule educational sessions for their members. It gives us better language to talk from, and it offers us a way then to go out and say, won't you become a dementia friend? Won't you become a dementia organization? Here's what it means, Good said. The Innovation Center started the application process last fall by bringing together a cross-section of community members from various organizations to talk about the level of education about dementia that is currently available in the county and how that could be increased. The group then formed an action team, which includes people who work in retirement communities and healthcare, as well as a person living with dementia and someone who is the primary caregiver for a family member living with dementia. The action team filled out the application, which included performing an analysis of the strengths and weaknesses in the county when it comes to understanding and supporting people living with dementia. Good said the programs provided by the Innovation Center, which opened in June 2023, have made Linn County a better place for people living with dementia, but there still is room to improve. Currently, in Linn County, we estimate that there are about 4,700 people living with dementia, and by 2050, we think it will be three times that many, Good said. So if you don't know somebody now that's living with dementia, you probably will. The Innovation Center and the dementia-friendly Linn County Action Team will host an event in the Innovation Center's parking lot at 9000 C Avenue Northeast in Marion from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. on June 20th that will officially launch dementia-friendly Linn County, and to provide community members an opportunity to learn more about the program and get to know some of the Innovation Center's clients. In an article from Kylie Alger, a certified wellness coach and co-owner of the Well Woman Body, Mind, and Spirit, we have this article. Since we just celebrated April Fool's Day earlier this week, I thought it would be fun to examine the many benefits of having a good laugh. Did you know that children laugh on average over 300 times a day, and adults only 20? Why am I talking about humor in a health column? Well, it turns out that science is revealing that laughter is not only fun, but that laughter is the best medicine. No joke. I recently learned that there are doctors who recommend laugh therapy for their transplant patients before their major surgeries. Amazing! Turns out laughter releases endorphins, the body's natural feel-good chemicals, which can promote an overall sense of well-being, boost the immune system, and decrease stress and anxiety. Journalist Norman Cousins gained widespread attention when he reported that he was able to significantly reduce the pain he endured with his symptoms of ankylosing spondylitis, arthritis of the spine. He reported that he regularly watched Marx Brothers comedy movies and observed a notable improvement in his pain levels. Cousins documented his experiences in his book Anatomy of an Illness, which played a pivotal role in highlighting the therapeutic benefits of humor and laughter in health and healing. Don't have anything to laugh about? That's okay. Charles Schaefer, professor of psychology, says that forced laughter is a powerful, readily available, and a cost-free way for many adults to boost their mood and psychological well-being. Schaefer directed study participants to smile broadly for 60 seconds, laugh heartily for 60 seconds, and howl like a wolf for 60 seconds. He found laughing and smiling both helped boost the participants' spirits, but howling did not. Forced laughter was the best medicine. 1 minute of forced laughing showed a significantly greater improvement than 1 minute of smiling, Schaefer said. But forced laughter? How? The professor explained that the body doesn't know whether it's fake, even though your brain might. Once the brain signals the body to laugh, the body doesn't care why. It's going to release endorphins. It's going to relieve stress as a natural physiological response to the physical act of laughing. Professor Schaefer believes laughing does at least four things for you. It energizes you, it cheers you up, it relaxes you, it rejuvenates you. For adults, you feel younger, he said. There are many stand-up comedy shows available on Netflix, YouTube, Sirius XM Radio, and podcasts. Or search for Laughter Yoga on YouTube for free sessions. I tried laughter yoga from a YouTube video while my kids were home. Sure, I felt silly at first mimicking the movements and forced laughter, but then it became real laughter when my kids started laughing with me. We were laughing so much my cheeks hurt afterward. And guess what? It felt so refreshing. We had the best afternoon after leaving. After laughing. So, I'm a believer. If you're looking for something to do today, the Film 2024 Cedar Rapids Film Festival. Catch cinematic excellence at this showcase of diverse, thought-provoking films from talented filmmakers from across the country, all with an Iowa connection. Visit CRIFM.org for a schedule of the films. It will be from 9 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. at the Collins Road Theaters, 1462 Twixtown Road in Marion. The cost varies from $5 to $45. The Literary Friends of the Cedar Rapids Public Library is having its big spring book sale. Check out the large selection of new and gently used books for all ages and interests, including giftables, at this big biannual sale. Proceeds support literacy programs in our community. They will be from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Cedar Rapids Public Library, 450 Fifth Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost varies. The First Friday Jazz, Chris Murr's Shorter Stories. Performing will be Chris Murr's, professor of music and director of jazz studies and director of the University of Northern Iowa Jazz Band since 2002. It will be from 5 to 7 p.m. at the Opus Concert Cafe, 119 3rd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost was $15. As a queer black woman, creative, mother of three, and radical truth-teller, Annie Mack's lived experience provides a deep wealth of knowledge and insight into what it is like to navigate oppressive systems while trying to pursue black joy, healing, and justice. Her most recent album, Testify, came out in 2021, is a blend of blues, country, rock, and soul. It will be from 8 to 11 p.m. at CSPS Hall, 1103 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The cost varies from $20 to $25. And we end with a community letter from Shirley Rudy, Cedar Rapids. LSU came loaded for bear at the Elite Eight game with the Iowa Hawkeyes on Monday in Albany, New York. But the Hawkeyes came loaded for tiger, and load they did. Those Hawks swooped down on that Tiger team and showed LSU and a sold-out crowd of screaming fans that size doesn't matter. A sharp-eyed Hawk can pummel a fearsome Tiger into submission, and it certainly did, 94-87. With, I might add, the legendary Caitlin Clark, who earned every bit of her reputation, going on to score 41 points and, according to the Associated Press, tied a women's NCAA tournament record Monday night by hitting 9 3-pointers, many from well beyond the arc. Yep, those women Hawkeyes sunk their talons deep into tiger fur and carried them off into the night. ESPN reports that 12.3 million viewers watched the contest, more than any other college basketball game in the network's history. Now, on to UConn. It is ironic that in high school, Caitlin's dream school during recruitment was the University of Connecticut, which, among the prestigious schools, never gave her a scholarship offer. Bet they're crying husky tears. Tigers, buffaloes, huskies, never underestimate a hawk. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Friday, April 5th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.